Scripture reading this morning is found in the Gospel according to Luke, chapter 15, verses 11 through 22, or 32. You'll find this page number is listed in your bulletin. I would encourage you, since this is a story, if you want to read along, you may, or you may just want to listen and hear it, perhaps as we hope Jesus might have spoken it. The context is that Jesus, in the course of his ministry, was confronted as often by the Pharisees. He was welcoming tax collectors and sinners, and they were gathering around him. And the Pharisees and the teachers of the law were saying in a rather contemptuous way, "This man welcomes sinners and eats with them." And then he tells them some stories about a lost sheep, a lost coin, and then now about this father and his two sons. There was a man who had two sons. The younger one said to his father, "Father, give me my share of the estate." So he divided his property between them. Not long after that, the younger son got together all he had, set off for a distant country, and there squandered his wealth in wild living. After he had spent everything, there was a severe famine in that whole country, and he began to be in need. So he went and hired himself out to a citizen of that country who sent him to his field to feed pigs. He longed to fill his stomach with the pods that the pigs were eating, but no one gave him anything. When he came to his senses, he said, "How many of my father's hired men have food to spare, and here I am starving to death. I will set out and go back to my father and say to him, 'Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me like one of your hired men.' So he got up and went to his father. But while he was still a long way off, his father saw him and was filled with compassion for him. He ran to his son, threw his arms around him, and kissed him. The son said to the father, 'Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. I'm no longer worthy to be called your son.' But the father said to his servants, 'Quick, bring the best robe and put it on him. Put a ring on his finger and sandals on his feet. Bring the fattened calf and kill it. Let's have a feast and celebrate. For this son of mine was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found.' So they began to celebrate. Meanwhile, the older son, was in the field. When he came near the house, he heard music and dancing. So he called one of the servants and asked him what was going on. 'Your brother has come,' he replied, 'and your father has killed the fattened calf because he has him back safe and sound.' The older brother became angry and refused to go in. So his father went out and pleaded with him. But he answered his father saying, 'Look, all these years I've been slaving for you and you never disobeyed your orders at all. You never gave me even a younger goat so I could celebrate with my friends. But when this son of yours who has squandered your property with prostitutes comes home, you kill the fattened calf for him.' 'My son,' the father said, 'you are always with me, and everything I have is yours. But we had to celebrate and be glad, because this brother of yours was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found.' May God bless to our hearing and understanding the ministry of his word this day."
Isn't it interesting how children conceived in the same womb with the same genetic code and who then grow up in the same home can be so very, very different? I am one of three sons. Two of us look slightly alike, but we are as different in personality, temperament, career, as any three sons could be. I have two sons who could scarcely be more different. Jesus once told a story about a family that had two very different sons. You heard that read this morning. It is often called the parable of the prodigal son. These two sons were as different as night and day. The older of the two was a father and mother's dream. He was obedient, a good boy, God-fearing, a son who chose to stay home and take care of his aging parents. In fact, he took over the family business and ran it just like his father did, much to the pleasure of his father. He was, above all else, a conformist. He was what every parent hopes for in a son. The younger son, as is often the case, rejected his parents' values, their religion. He was a nonconformist who couldn't wait to escape the confining atmosphere of that home. He no doubt was resentful of his older brother, and he certainly resented his father. The story tells us that. He was, in fact, the parents' worst fear. This story is told in Luke chapter 15, and in it is a profound and powerful summary of the Christian gospel. Jesus told it to some very religious folk who desperately needed to hear it. And I submit to you that it is as necessary today as it was then, for it is a story which is as often misunderstood as understood. It is a story that has three scenes in it, and we seldom get beyond the first scene. And our concentration on the son, which is the first scene, blinds us to the power of the story, which comes in the second and the third scenes. The first scene, as I mentioned, features the young son's rebellion, and many of us know it well. The family style of that home was one of authoritarianism, for it was an authoritarian world. J. Duncan Derrett, who writes on the social atmosphere and the laws of the first century, wrote a book about Jesus' audience trying to explain what that world looked like and felt like to people of the first century. Interestingly, the first chapter has to do with the social setting, and the first part of the chapter is a description of gender distinctions in the first century, for that mattered more than anything else in the social structure of the first century. The second subject he deals with is the family and parental authority in particular. Listen to how he writes about the parental authority, understanding that this is his initial description of the social scene of the first century. After a child reached the age of five, he began to learn that the society was duty-oriented, not right-oriented. Except in commercial contexts where rights dominated, no one was concerned about his rights. Everyone wanted to know his duties and wished to be thought worthy to fulfill them. No one questioned the right of parents to their sons' earnings, nor the duty of the latter to obey and support their parents indefinitely. Obedience was so taken for granted that the biblical provision for the stoning of stubborn and rebellious sons was virtually a dead letter, because sons were that obedient. Even if one were to desert a father with his consent, one would be disobeying the command to obey your mother and father. A son was always inferior to his father. My father was a commonplace form of respectful address. Elder sons, as their father's right hands, would rule over younger sons and would enforce necessary respect from them. Silence became younger people. The elder brother, particularly the eldest, was often disinclined to be generous and compassionate, and younger brothers had a reputation for rebelliousness and ill-concealed resentment, both against their elder brother and against their father. And he goes on for pages in the same vein. See, it was the obligation of sons, elder and younger, in the first century, to provide lifetime care for their parents, and even to care for other relatives in the family who were called by the rabbis unprofitable relatives. Get the power of that, unprofitable relatives. But there was an obligation to care even for them. It was for the people of the first century a fifth commandment issue. For the fifth commandment says, thou shalt honor your father and your mother. People of the first century added obey to honor, and honoring included obeying. And the obligation of a son, in particular, to the father and mother was lifetime care as one of the ways of honoring your father and your mother. The religion of the time was a religion of obligations and duty. And conformity was the highest social value. And in this family, that had begun to break down. There was a parent-son struggle. One son who wouldn't conform. One son who demanded his independence against everything in that culture of conformity. And there no doubt was a sibling rivalry as well between the younger brother who was the nonconformist and the older brother who was the conformist, who no doubt was thought of as daddy's boy. And like many sons then and now, the younger son made a fateful decision to leave home. And like most boys and daughters who leave home, he misjudged reality. The harshness of that conformist home caused him not only to misjudge his own home and to see it misfocused, but he also misjudged the reality which lay outside of his home, which looked far more alluring than it really was. But he made the decision to leave, and his father, wise man that he was, determined to let him go. The father had no obligation legally to allow the son to have his inheritance at this time. But the father wisely again determined that to either reject this son or to forbid him to practice his independence would be to lose him forever. The one link that the father would continue to have with the son was his grace and his generosity in the midst of the son's rebellion. And so the property was divided before the legal time. The younger son, as was the custom in that day, would have received about one-third of the property, and the eldest son the two-thirds, which was probably one of the things the young son was mad about to begin with. And consequently, the elder son was left with the responsibility for the financial care of his father and mother, because younger son took his property, cashed it in, or cashed it out, and left for a far country with his property, no longer to be used for the care of the mother and father, and that made the older son angrier with the younger son than he was before. But in addition to those somewhat technical legal issues, there were some moral issues involved as well. What the younger son did was contrary to God's law, in addition to contrary to the law of the culture, for this son rejected the father's moral claim to the property which that father gave to the son. You see, the father had earned that property, and the son had no moral claim on it. The father did. But the father delivered it over to the younger son, who then rejected the father's claim to that which the father indeed had earned, and claimed, I can take what is mine, though it really wasn't his. He could go to a far country, and he could do anything that he wanted to, which was moral rebellion, in addition to family rebellion. He was rebelling, obviously, against the fifth commandment, at least as those people understood it. And in leaving home, he did more than leaving his physical roots. He left his spiritual and moral roots as well. And the description of his life in the far country tells how far he overthrew what he had known all of his life. He defected, you see, not only from his home, but he defected from whatever he had been taught about right and wrong and what he had been taught about God. His spiritual roots he defected from as well. And again, many of you know the story. The son, in not too long of a time, suffered ruin. He wasted his fortune in what Luke calls wild living, and in the process lost whatever character he may have grown up with and whatever sense of values he had inherited from his family and from his faith. Indeed, he lost his soul, which is far more valuable than the loss of anything else. And that which he had grasped for so desperately, which was freedom, he lost and found himself in bondage to his own desires with no control over his finances and no control over his body and no control over his conscience or his soul. And he lost it all. And what his friends may have seen outside, a facade of smiles, laughter, fashionable clothes perhaps, inside, he knew there was another reality. As Helmut Thielicke puts it so profoundly, inside, Thielicke writes, he hears the rattle of the chains in which he walks, and they are beginning to make him groan. Even before his substance was gone, he had lost what he had grasped for he no longer was a free man. And when he came to the end of his substance, he found himself, horror of horrors, not only a poverty-stricken young man, but he found himself in slavery to a Gentile. And the Gentile's only job for the young man was that the young man feed pigs. And it's difficult for us to understand the cultural horror of a first century Jewish person not only touching a pig, but living with pigs. And horror of horrors, eating what the pigs ate. One of the rabbis said, cursed is the man who keeps swine or teaches his son Greek philosophy. There was, you see, a revulsion and a horror of the outside world. Another rabbi said, don't throw a swine herder into a pit, but don't pull him out of one either. Bitter laughter goes up from the pigsty. For the man who had claimed his freedom as a slave to a Gentile, to his own passions. He who had been wealthy was impoverished by that very freedom that he claimed, and a fortune sits in a pigsty, starving to death. But then the biblical text goes on with this profound little sentence in the midst of it all. Indeed, this is the dramatic pivot of the entire story. He came to himself. In the pigsty, there was a moment of brilliant clarity amidst all of the confusion and the fuzzy thinking of past months. Alone in the world, he finally understood that what he had grasped was an empty cul-de-sac. There was nothing there. To leave home and to leave his roots, to wander from his father and to squander his soul and his fortune, was nothing. He realized that the source of his wealth and the source of his being was what he had overthrown. And in a moment of that clarity, he saw reality for the first time in his life. Not only that home was good, but he also saw that running from his father's home was no answer. And he dropped his foolish pride, which was the one thing that had caused him to leave in the first place, and was the only secret to restoration. He dropped it and said, I will go home. And in that moment, you see, he once again recognized his father's claim on his life. I will go to the source from which I have wandered. I will go to that country from which I came. I will return to the source of my being as well as my fortune, and I will agree that if my father will merely keep me from starving, I will be his slave. I have no moral claim on him, though he has a moral claim on me. I don't expect to be restored as a son. I have overthrown that. I will be a slave. And in that brilliant moment of clarity, he claimed responsibility for his own life. No longer did he blame his older brother for ruining his life, nor did he blame his religion for twisting him beyond measure, nor did he blame his parents for suppressing him, the younger son. He laid claim to his own soul and gave it back to his father. He said, I have sinned against my father and against heaven. And then listen to these powerful words, I will go home. The proud boy became a humbled adult who was willing to work as a slave and even suffer the rejection of his family, which he probably assumed had already happened, simply to be home. And he was going home with empty hands. He had nothing to give his father save himself. And that's where our attention in the story usually stops. That's the end of the first scene. But here the story takes an astonishing twist, at least an astonishing twist for a man or a woman of the first century listening to Jesus tell this story. It may be astonishing to us. It is the second scene. And the second scene is no longer in the far country. The second scene is back home again. And the scene opens with a father who is waiting for his son to come home against all cultural expectation. Herman Wolk, a Jewish American writer, recently wrote a book, Outside Inside, in which he attempts to describe the American Jewish experience. It is a marvelous book if you want to understand the American Jewish experience. And the title is crafted carefully, Inside, Outside. Two worlds, the inside world of the Jewish community and the outside world that is the Gentile world. And the two did not mix well. Then, and sometimes they don't mix well now. The inside-outside notion was of intense commitment and conviction in the first century. Very often, a son who wandered from home and wandered from his faith was considered dead. And there was a funeral service held for an apostatized son. One who left his family and in so doing left his faith and his culture and his nation and his God. He was no longer a son. He was dead. The son, no doubt, as he wandered down that road toward the waiting father, had no idea that his father would be waiting. He undoubtedly thought his father had forgotten him and written him out of his life. He undoubtedly expected rejection. After all, he was hopelessly contaminated and lost. He had disgraced not only himself, he disgraced his family. And disgracing his family, he disgraced his tribe and his nation and his God. The only hope that this young man had was a very slender one indeed, that there would be some mercy which would fall off the edge of his father's table so he wouldn't starve to death anymore. He undoubtedly expected to live the rest of his life in intense shame and awesome guilt, not only in himself, but repeatedly given to him by his family and his neighbors and his entire nation. He could never hold his head up again, but at least he would be alive. But as I say, that's the astonishing twist. The father is not at all like what one would expect a first century father to be like. The father is waiting. There was no life as usual for this father. He continued to look down the road to wait for his son to return. And in verse 20, there is a powerful picture of a father's heart. And the whole story, you see, having pivoted now upon the son's coming to himself, reaches a new pivot point as the heart of the father is described before the action of the father is described. For Jesus said, the father saw him come over the horizon, and he was filled with compassion. And having been filled with compassion, he does something which is astonishing once again, unheard of for a first century Oriental man who's the head of a home. He ran to his son, very undistinguished, threw his arms around him, and kissed him. With no speech, with no recrimination, with no guilt, and with no conditions. I came home one time very late when I was a youth, and I had gotten myself in danger with a broken down car. And came home very late and was just happy to be alive. And I walked in the door, and my mother, bless her heart, rather than welcoming me home, said, where have you been? Well, I understand now that I'm a father of teenagers, I might have that same reaction. But note that the father didn't say that. Nor did the father say what often a father then, and maybe a father even now, I've heard a father or two say this, look what you've done to your mother. Nor did he say, son, when you get your act together and when you get your life organized and when I see in you some measure of responsibility, then I'll let you into the servant's shed, and if you do well there, perhaps I'll let you back into your room again. Didn't say that at all. Moreover, he didn't fold his arms and give a frown of disapproval to the son, which we might want to do to at least teach the son a lesson about something. Not at all. The picture of the father is a man running down the road, robes flowing behind him with his arms outstretched and tears running down his face, welcoming his son home. He was waiting, and he goes to his son. What do you suppose that did to the insides of that young man? I recall a number of years ago, a man in a congregation I was pastoring had a son very much like this younger son, except he was the eldest, but he went away to Seattle and spent his fortune in riotous living and gave up his faith and his family with a lot of alienation between himself and his family, himself and the faith he grew up in, and became a rather dissolute person. God, in a miraculous way, met him on a Damascus road, very similar to the Apostle Paul's, and he came back to his faith and came back to his family and came back to his church. I recall the father meeting me after morning service when that first had happened on a Saturday night preceding, and the son and the father, who was a hard man, had lived a hard life, with tears streaming down his face, quoted from this parable, he said, "My son who is dead lives. He has come home." And he hugged me. The heart of a father. Note Jesus' point, you see. And after this, there is unrestrained joy. There is the placing of the son back in his original position with robe and signet ring and sandals. And the killing of the fatted calf. It's the one calf which was waiting for a feast day. The feast day has arrived, the father said, and there's unrestrained joy in the house. There's an orchestra playing and people dancing and noise coming out the windows, and the son has been welcomed home because of the father's heart. Note Jesus' point, again I say. This is a parable in defense of Jesus' ministry. There are many messages that one can draw out of this parable, but here the central one. The most basic message and perhaps a corrective in your view about God. For this parable is a message about the God that Jesus came to reveal, who does not sit with his arms folded and stern face looking for us to mess up so he can squash us. Not at all. The God of Jesus is a God who runs to us with open arms, tears streaming down his face, crying, "Welcome home, son, welcome home, daughter." And his kingdom, therefore, ought to be a party with unrestrained joy. Even though we, like the younger son, have no moral claims on God's mercy, for we too have left and gone to a far country. We left the source of life in our rebellion against God, in our insane desire to have it our own way, to be independent, of God to be independent and free moral agents. But at the first sign of our coming home, he runs to us with open arms, not with stern face. How about your God? Does he welcome you with warm embrace, or is he a stern taskmaster? Do you have the God of Jesus, or the God of your own imagination? And how about you? Perhaps you have left your heavenly Father to strike out on your own, proud and independent of God, and you can do it by yourself. Jesus invites you to come to yourself. Either you have messed it up already or you will. For you see, thrown back on ourselves, we have very, very little to grasp. A Jewish psychologist by the name of Martin Seligman has written a lot about the current generation of young adults, which he calls a generation adrift. Adrift from their God, adrift from their family, adrift from their people, their tribe, their nation, thrown back on themselves. And he says that is an exceedingly slender hope. You can come home to the waiting Father, for after all, he's the source of everything. All that you're squandering is his to begin with, for he gave it. You can come home. But you've got to decide. The Father is waiting and the Father runs to meet us. But we've got to take responsibility for our own lives and say, "I have sinned. I will go home." But the story still isn't finished. The third scene is equally powerful, and this is the one we seldom see at all. In this chapter is, the scene rather, is the story of the elder brother, who, coming home from the fields, where dutiful son that he is, he's been working long hours for his father. Hears the music coming out of the windows and perhaps sees the shadow of the dancing figures on the shade and wonders what's going on in his father's house where he has lived for years and hasn't seen anything quite like this. So he asks the servant what's going on, and the servant tells him joyously, "Your younger brother who was dead has now come home," and there's a party. And years of resentment erupted into the father's face. As the young man shook his finger at his father, a son who understood the language of duty but did not understand the language of the heart, whose life had been lived under obligation, and a life lived under duty or obligation as the base for behavior always will produce anger and resentment and judgment and bitterness and an unforgiving heart, a grim face and quick judgment. In other words, self-righteous. He, after all, had been a good boy. He'd stayed home, he'd taken care of his father, he'd done all the work when he only should have done half of it. He was caring for his father as he and his mother aged. He had gone to synagogue on Sabbath and dutifully read the Torah and had kept the law, and therefore thought he had a moral claim on his father because of his duty and because of his fulfilling of the obligation. And that's the difference between Christianity and every other religion. Every other religion, including some who claim the name of Christ, think by duty and obligation they have some claim on the Father. Some moral claim because of what we do for Him. And the parable of the waiting father tells us that we have no moral claim on God. We must come like the younger son with empty hands, or we have nothing at all. For all that we do becomes self-righteousness. That's Jesus' point. It's the fundamental mistake of most religious folk who think that a religion of duty somehow or another fulfills the claims of the Father. And it doesn't. And you see, this kind of religious person, Christian or otherwise, is always easily identified. The elder son stands out like a sore thumb. To change the picture, he has his finger of accusation always shaking. He has a lifted nose of disapproval as he looks down on younger sons. He has the folded arms of rejection. There's something unhappy about this man, and he's always unhappy about something. He has, if you will, the spiritual gift of discouragement. And the reason he does is he thinks he can lay claim to God's mercy by something he has done. And Jesus says, no! For that son who thinks he lives in the Father's house, in fact, doesn't at all. He lives in another kind of house altogether. He lives in a wretched house that he has erected. And what a wretched thing it is to call oneself a Christian and yet be a stranger and a grumbling servant in the Father's house. For you see, those who come to God with personal moral claim go away empty. For the Christian faith, as Jesus taught it, is a religion which has at its base love. Love for God and love for neighbor. A love like the Father's waiting heart. Jesus always describes his disciples in terms of what they are on the inside. He gives a profile of their heart. And then what these disciples of his do is a response not to some obligation, but is a response to the loving heart of a waiting father, which has now been shared with a waiting son. Your Christianity, and this is a fine point which is hard for us to understand, is your Christianity a matter of duty and obligation? And do you make your way through your faith with a grim face and a judgmental spirit? Or does your faith make you smile? Is your faith in your relationship to this waiting father who has open arms and tears streaming down his face, is your faith a party of welcome, of joyous obedience, rather than grim obligation that makes life so hard? See, it all boils down really to one sentence. Are you living under the smile of God? I really fear sometimes we don't want the God that Jesus came to reveal. For some perverse reason, we prefer duty rather than love. We opt for obligation rather than grace. We find it so very difficult to imagine a God on the run coming to us with open arms. We really want to come to Him like the elder son with some claim on His mercy. After all, we've stayed home, said our prayers, gone to church, read the Bible, and been good boys and girls. But He insists in Jesus, that we come like the younger brother, without claim, with empty hands at the end of ourselves. See, we really, I fear, don't want a joyous party. We're afraid of grace. And so often after we move into our Father's house, we quickly come to resemble the elder brother and inside build an ugly shack. See, Jesus says today, come to the Father, for He is waiting. Some of you need to get out of the pigsty and go home to your Heavenly Father. Most of us who are here this morning think that we live in the Father's house, and some of us need to tear down the shack we built in our bedroom of the Father's house and come into His bedroom and live in joyous, loving obedience. Either way, if you're in a pigsty or if you're in a shack, the waiting Father waits and says, come home. The only question, you see, is whether we're going to have the penetrating insight to come to ourselves and to lay no claim on Him, but to come with empty hands and experience Him welcome us, running down the road with open arms and tears of joy. And after that, it's a joyous party. Will you come home? Let us pray. Father, forgive us for our perverse self-righteousness that causes us to build ugly shacks in Your house. To somehow or another think because we've stayed home and been good boys and girls or men and women, said our prayers and done religious things, we somehow have a claim on Your mercy. Empty our hands and teach us the lesson of the waiting Father. May You be to each of us on this day the smiling Father of Jesus, not the grim God of so much of contemporary faith. Deliver us from ourselves and welcome us home for Jesus' sake and also for our sake. Amen.